Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name is James Henderson. I'm a Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute, and with me today is Vitaly Yermakov, who is a Senior Research Fellow, and who has written a paper which is called Follow the Money, Russia's Oil and Gas Revenues, which looks at what we can learn from the data around revenues coming out of Russia about the state of the oil and gas industry. That paper was published in mid-March, and we're recording this podcast on the 22nd of March at 11 o'clock in the morning UK time, just to date stamp where we are. But Vitaly, welcome back to the OIES podcast series.
Hello, good to be back and good to be with you.
Great. Well, look, Vitaly, let's start off by asking a general question, if I may. I mean, your paper is deliberately based around a lot of statistics and what we can learn from them. But how easy is it to get that data, especially as the Russian government seems to have banned publication of oil and gas production figures? How easy is it for you to get the information you need?
Well, it has never been easy to get the statistics on the Russian energy sector. It has always been a struggle. You had to dig for data, do real statistical excavations. Now, of course, the difficulty is many orders of magnitude greater than it used to be. Russia indeed pretty much said that no official statistics on Russian, disaggregated statistics on Russian oil and gas, specifically oil output, is going to be released. Some data on gas output are released. But it also allowed the companies like Gazprom and Novatek not to disclose the information which they previously were required to disclose. So, yeah, the flow of data is very limited. And when you don't have the data, you cannot really do a research paper that is based on some real numbers, not just estimates. And my paper looks at the data that was officially reported by the Ministry of Finance. It's quite surprising that this data is freely available. The Ministry of Finance publishes this data every month, and it contains the numbers on Russia's overall oil and gas revenues with the breakdown by the type of tax. I think it's quite useful to look at changes in the composition of the oil and gas tax take, and also to look at the changes in absolute levels of Russian oil and gas revenues. It gives you indirect but very valuable source of insight on what has been happening in the Russian oil and gas sector.
Okay, good. Well, look, let's go back in history a bit then. I mean, your paper highlights that Russia has become more resilient in the face of sanctions that have been imposed since 2014. Can you just expand a bit on that resilience as you see it?
Well, the paper doesn't specifically looks at the sanctions. It just looks at the overall economic context in which sort of these revenue streams have been happening. But clearly, a lot of new developments in Russia have been driven by the sanctions. And you might remember this line, this famous line from that movie, Lawrence of Arabia. What's the trick? Well, the trick is not minding. And apparently Russia is not minding the sanctions. How is Russia doing that? Well, from the start, I think the question about the sanction was whether Russia is too big to basically to be sanctioned. And it turns out that, yes, Russia is too big an economy to be sanctioned. The second thing, out of 194 countries that are members of the United Nations, only 44 countries have introduced sanctions against Russia. That's about 20%. So it's the US, the UK, EU27, plus like five or six countries in Europe that are not members of the EU, Switzerland, Norway, and others, Japan, Australia. So we essentially have used this term, the collective West, that has introduced the sanctions against Russia. But Asia, Latin America, Africa, well, most importantly, China, India, these countries, they have not introduced any sanctions against Russia. Obviously, companies from these countries might have concerns about secondary sanctions that might be applied to them if they continue trade with Russia. But so far, generally, the global trade has continued, and the sanctions have not interrupted it completely. It has been a case of basically great inconvenience for the Russian economy, but not something that could derail it.
Okay, well, look, you've mentioned the revenue figures that have come out from the Ministry of Finance. Let's get into those. I mean, they're clearly a vital component of the overall budget revenues, but can you give us some figures, especially what the impact has been in terms of, you know, how relevant the exchange rate's been, what the impact on GDP has been, as well as the export and budget revenues? Give us some numbers as you look back at the figures.
Well, there's always a danger of basically just starting quoting numbers without context. So I will try to give some numbers and also the overall context. Oil and gas, first point, is the most important source of revenue for the Kremlin. But its share in total federal budget revenue has been fluctuating. And in recent years, it has gone down from about 50%. And 50% it was basically the case in 2011, 2013, when oil prices were extremely high, over $100 per barrel, when Russia was exporting tremendous amount of gas into the European Union, and prices for natural gas were quite high. Now, in 2023, the share of oil and gas revenues in the federal budget went down to 33%. However, the overall level of budgetary revenue in ruble terms, and I think it's important, is the highest on record. And this clearly has to do with the weak ruble policy that the Russian Central Bank has been using. So it was the most natural response by the Russian government to allow the ruble to depreciate, which would increase the ruble amounts the budget would receive. Even the value of exports in hard currency terms would decline, and weaker ruble obviously compensates for that. There's always a danger of introducing this policy because it clearly has inflationary second-order effects. Russia, quite miraculously, has so far managed to avoid a major spike in inflation. I mean, there was a spike in 2022, but it was suppressed, and it really had to do with the fact that historically Russia has been a major net exporter of capital. Also, the Russian government consistently used very prudent estimates for its budgetary expenditures in the past, and now when the Russian economy, for all intents and purposes, is on a military footing, sort of all this excess revenue, instead of being exported to abroad in the form of capital flight, essentially went into, most of it has been absorbed into military spending, into higher social payments, into higher payments to the military personnel and their families, compensation for the dead and the wounded. And sort of it's a very natural Keynesian effect, additional money supply. It was because of the sanctions. It was basically, it had to circulate within the Russian economy. In the past, a lot of this money would leave Russia and would end up like in foreign bank accounts. But now it's clearly impossible. And a lot of this additional money supply basically is fueling not just Russian military enterprises, but also lots of businesses that operate in Russia. And the result, at least in the near term, was quite robust GDP growth, 3.6% in 2023.
Okay, well, let's come back, if I can, to more specifically the oil and gas revenues and what your conclusions you're drawing about the sector. You make a point about how the Russian state has successfully managed taxation. And I think that's a sort of very much a long-term trend, actually, you know, even since the 1990s. But can you just elaborate on what's been happening recently with oil and gas taxation and how important that's been to the companies involved to create the incentives for them to get out there and continue to develop and produce hydrocarbons?
Fiscal policies and budgetary policies, they're obviously interconnected, and balancing them is important. And one of the titles for subchapters in my paper is "The State Giveth and the State Taketh Away." And so taxation obviously is the most important above the ground factor for the performance of the oil and gas sector. And here, just looking at the change in the composition of the tax take in terms of which fiscal instruments being applied, I think we could see some important changes and draw some important insights. Many of these measures, by the way, were not specifically sanctions driven. Some of them were introduced prior to 2014. They turn out to be quite useful in the new situation. For example, Russia has been trying to reduce the role of export taxation in its overall take by relying more on the upstream levy called mineral extraction resource tax, MRET, which is essentially like something that would be called a mineral royalty in most of the world. But in Russia, it's this levy has been called a tax. It's basically part of the Russian tax code. Royalties normally site-specific applied by local authorities on the basis of like project economics. In Russia, this levy was codified in the tax code, and it was basically one-size-fits-all instrument. And there were some modifications based on the volume of oil prices. Basically, when oil price was higher, this tax would go up. When oil price goes down, this tax would go down because of the sliding scale linked to the Urals crude that was part of the mechanism. But other than that, it was quite inflexible because it didn't take costs or project economics into account. So by basically trying to do this proxy arrangement, by trying just to follow oil price movements, of course, this would be insufficient for many big ticket projects, for many depleted fields. And as a result, in Russia over the years, like since early 2000s, many site-specific tax exemptions have flourished. The state had basically to give specific exemptions to specific fields, just not to let them fail. There were so many of those that the Ministry of Finance at a certain point became quite concerned that almost 90% of Russian oil output would be covered by those special exemptions. And they decided, well, let's change that. And to do that, they introduced a series of reforms. And sort of when you touch one element of the tax system, of a complex tax system, usually, well, you have to adjust many other elements because simply just changing one element may introduce some cascading effects that might have negative or unexpected consequences. So it was a complex task that required like multiple adjustments in many parts of the system. So first thing, the tax burden was shifted away from export tax and sort of for greater reliance on this mineral extraction resource-based tax. And this can be clearly seen from the data. This happened gradually over the course of several years, but now, essentially, the export tax has been reduced to a bare minimum, and most of our tax collection happens on the MRT side. Interestingly, this helped to shield the budget from all negative consequences of the sanctions, at least in terms of the volume of exports affected by the sanctions or temporarily affected by the sanctions, because the basis of taxation is total extracted volume. The whole adjustment comes not on the budget, but on the companies, on the producers. And the producers, they probably are more flexible and they can adjust the expenditure. So at least in the near term, that was quite helpful to shield the Russian budget from the negative effects of the sanctions and volume restrictions on purchase of Russian crude. Then when you get rid of export taxes, all of a sudden, there's a new problem. Export taxation was setting an important wedge between international prices abroad and domestic prices at home for Russia. Once you remove this, generally, the export parity levels would go up. Domestic prices for motor fuels in particular would be going up because there would be no protection from this from this wedge from the export tax. Clearly, the Russian government didn't like that. Nobody likes when prices of fuel go up and people are quite unhappy. It's also one of the most important metrics of success pretty much everywhere in the world. And to address this issue, the Russian government had to introduce another new element, basically the so-called negative excise tax, which was like a subsidy, an effective subsidy to the oil companies in exchange for them keeping retail prices at the pump under control, not raising them very significantly, even when international prices for oil and refined products go up. So it was basically an attempt to protect the domestic market from the cyclicality and volatility of international prices of crude and products, which worked relatively well. Then this mineral resource extraction tax, as we stated from the start, is insensitive to costs. To address this problem, the Russian government had to introduce another new element in the system, which is called additional profits tax, which is in concept a cash flow-based tax. It is sensitive to costs. It responds to incentives. It is very beneficial for high-cost projects, for new developments, also for depleted fields. It was introduced basically on a pilot basis just for a handful of projects. A few years ago, it moved from sort of this testing ground to general application. Now it covers over 20% of oil produced in Russia. And I think this has been quite remarkable and a sign that the Russian government is ready to accept new realities, to be flexible in terms of how to incentivize the industry, how to give it a booster shot, if you will. Now, one of the reasons why Russia's oil output has been quite robust as well, not just the economic performance of the country, but oil output as well.
Given that then, and that rebalancing of export tax and mineral resource tax and the introduction of additional profits tax, what can we say about the role of hydrocarbon revenues? You've kind of mentioned they've declined as a share of overall revenues. Is that expected to continue? I mean, if we're taking into account costs now, then presumably there'll be a balancing and perhaps sort of a lower impact of oil and gas revenues on the budget and non-oil revenues increasing. I mean, was that the trend you're seeing?
Well, I think the single most important factor that determines the share, I think it's really the oil price. If oil price goes over $100 per barrel, clearly the share of oil and gas revenue would also increase. Like ceteris paribus, I think this healthy growth in non-oil and gas sectors of the Russian economy that we have seen, it ran counter to the expectations by many Western analysts. But apparently this idea that Russia is just basically a gas station masquerading as a state, well, it has been a strategic blunder. There are many sectors within Russian economy that are quite healthy, and it's not just the military industrial complex in Russia. Clearly, that has been probably the most important growth factor in the past year. But it has to do with Russia's economy basically now replacing foreign imports with domestic production of many goods and services. By sanctioning Russia and by leaving country, many foreign companies left Russia, but the equipment, the methodologies, the sort of the facilities, everything remained within the country. It was acquired on the cheap by the Russian owners. And now they're using this to continue serving the population. That has been another important element in the overall growth of Russia's economy. Some critical inputs, of course, are now banned. In many cases, Russia has managed to find acceptable substitutes to use the intermediaries in the Middle East, in China, to acquire some substitutes, or maybe acquire the same necessary inputs, but basically by using the so-called unofficial import. Again, back to my point that the sanctions have been a major inconvenience. They have not derailed the Russian economic development.
Okay, well, look, let me come to a slightly different angle then. I mean, in the past, you know, oil revenues have been really the important factor in hydrocarbon and gas, not so much. We haven't really talked much about gas now. Clearly, export revenues have gone down a lot. Sales to Europe are down from 150 BCM round numbers to 25. Clearly, exports to China are rising, but not remotely fast enough to compensate for that. And LNG exports, at least for new projects, are being impacted by both trade and technical sanctions. What can you say about the gas industry and its kind of importance now to Russian revenues?
You're right. But I think it's important to know that even historically, oil has been always much more important for the Russian budget than natural gas. And it's like 80% to 20%, oil representing 80% and gas representing 20% on average. Clearly, when Russia lost the European gas market, it represented a major problem. Redirecting oil and refined product flows to new markets was quite easy. Not quite easy, but manageable, simply because of the fungibility factor. Gas, pipeline gas infrastructure, basically links supplier and consumer by this long-term relationship. It's not easy to redirect this flow. To be sure, Russia has been trying to develop new markets in China, and exports of natural gas, pipeline natural gas to China have been growing and will continue to grow under already signed SPAs. But it is not going to compensate the loss of the European market for many years to come. And so, yes, gas potentially it's much problematic. But on the other hand, Russia has this huge domestic gas market, which is almost 500 BCM in size. This is, to be sure, this is a low margin market for domestic suppliers. They can barely break even selling to this market. But it would still keep Russia's gas industry operating. To the extent that Gazprom can export pipeline gas abroad, talking about China, Turkey, some remaining countries in Europe still taking Russian pipeline gas. This may not continue in the next few years, but so far the revenue from those export sales, well, is on the order of like $30 billion per annum overall. So this is something on top of basically breaking even at the domestic market that Gazprom in the near term could use to finance its investment program. Gazprom doesn't need to invest into upstream, really. It has so much spare gas productive capacity. So most of the new investment requirements would have to deal with constructing this new giant gas pipeline to China, 50 BCM, if indeed basically the contract is signed. Well, this is something probably could cost on the order of $25, $30 billion. So basically, it's just one year revenue from pipeline sales would cover the investment requirement for constructing this pipeline. Something manageable again. This looks like, obviously, some tough times for Gazprom, but not something that is going sort of to destroy the company.
Okay. I mean, as we get towards the end of our time here, let's just reach some overall conclusions about the state of the Russian oil and gas industry. You know, based on the numbers that you can see, the revenues that are coming in, the taxes that are being paid, what's your kind of conclusion about the state of the Russian oil and gas industry in Russia and its future?
With the oil sector, it looks like Russia has managed to avoid a major forced decline in the output. Russia is part of the OPEC Plus deal, so there were some cuts, but these were like really voluntary cuts, not driven by the technical factors or economic factors. And basically, it was Russia's position of working with Saudi Arabia within OPEC Plus on managing the global oil market. In this sense, I think Russia remains in the game here, remains a valuable member of OPEC Plus, would be able to essentially keep its oil output at the plateau for quite some time, especially if the new projects like Vostok Oil are eventually brought on stream. With gas, the story is much more difficult. With pipeline gas, clearly China now has this tremendous leverage over Russia for any new deals. On the LNG front, that's where I think some technological sanctions and especially the sanctions on transportation and logistics involving LNG carriers and reloading facilities that Russia planned to use for evacuating LNG. Clearly, these sanctions have been quite severe and had greater effect than probably Novatek expected earlier, in particular Arctic LNG 2 project, which technically is ready to ship its output, its LNG. Has so far not done so for the lack of LNG tankers. Basically, it's the most immediate reason. So delays and problems with Russia's gas expansion. But here again, I think it's a matter of time until Russia finds some alternative solutions here in the new markets. It probably would take much longer than with oil and refined products. But eventually, well, most of the world is still ready to trade with Russia. Remain in globalized world, not divided by sanctions and economic restrictions. And of course, ultimately, the conflict in Ukraine is not going to last forever. And I think once it's ended, probably indeed we are going to talk about a negotiated solution. Sanctions and trade restrictions might be part of the overall negotiated solution in the end.
Okay, great. Well, look, thanks, Vitaly, for your thoughts. I would recommend your paper to our listeners. It's on the OIES website now, so please feel free to to download it free of charge. Thanks for your insights, Vitaly. That's been fascinating to hear your thoughts. I hope that listeners have found it interesting too. Another podcast from the oil and gas programs will be out in the next couple of weeks, so look out for that. But in the meantime, do take care of yourselves. Thank you very much again for listening, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.